You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This is our Brighton Bestsellers show, where I invite three Brighton-based best-selling writers to tell us how they got to the top of the charts. So we have got the wonderful crime writer Ellie Griffiths, Dorothy Coombson, and Jack Jordan, and they will all be telling us about their journeys to the top, which are not always very straightforward. The Brighton Book Club is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. You can follow us on Instagram at BTN Book Club, and you can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Enjoy the show. First up in our wonderful lineup of Brighton bestsellers, we have author Ellie Griffiths. Ellie, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, lovely to be here.
Ellie, for anyone who doesn't know you, can you please introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your books?
Oh, well, hello, I'm Ellie Griffiths. I'm the author of 30 crime novels, including a series set in Brighton in the 1950s and 1960s theatrical world. But I'm probably best known for the Ruth Galloway mysteries, which are about a forensic archaeologist and set in Norfolk. And I've just had a book out in January, which is The Last Word, which is another crime novel set in West Sussex.
Are you ever not writing?
No, not really. But actually, after The Last Word, I've got a bit of a pause. I've got some short stories coming out later this year. I've actually got a little bit of a longer lead up because I'm writing a new series. So actually, that won't come out till 2025. And it's been a long time. I think it's been 15 years that I haven't written two books a year. So actually, the time is really wonderful. So I suppose the answer is I'm never not writing, but it's actually quite nice to be writing at a slightly slower pace this time.
So Ellie, you are prolific. You have written so much and you are so successful in your writing. It's a real honour to speak to you. But how did you go from first picking up that pen to becoming a bestseller? What was the journey?
Well, mine was quite a slow journey, which in a way I think is quite good. A little bit easier to cope with than becoming a huge mega success with your first book, which I used to be a publisher and you certainly see that sometimes and it's great and exciting. But it can be, I think, a little bit frightening, a little bit overwhelming. So yes, I was first published under my own name, which, as you know, Anna is Domenica De Rosa. I published, I guess, sort of women's fiction, books about sort of families, relationships, that sort of thing. Then I wrote a crime novel and my agent suggested I got a crime name. So that's how I became Ellie Griffiths. And that book, again, wasn't super successful. In fact, my first publisher didn't want it. They just wanted more of the same Domenica De Rosa book. So I went to a new publisher, Quercus, got a new editor, who's still my editor today, Jane Wood. And it was a very slow thing. And sometimes publishers call it a word of mouth success. And really it is when, and in my case, it was libraries and independent bookshops who started saying things to their readers, you know, places where people know their readers really well, and they'd say things like, oh, if you like Anne Cleves, I think you might like Ellie Griffiths, you know, if you like Peter Robinson, I think you'll like these books. So it was a slow thing, and it wasn't until about book five or six in the series that they hit the Sunday Times bestseller list, and I had my first number one bestseller last year. So a long time to become a number one bestseller.
And what do you wish that you knew along the way? I know that you kind of have a publishing background, so it might be a slightly kind of off-piste answer from you.
Well, I really wish that I knew that having a number one bestseller doesn't take away the imposter syndrome. I wish I could tell people that it did. And you know, writing 30 books, I'd still slightly pause when people say, you know, what do you do for a living, before saying I'm a writer. It just seems a really, you know, extraordinary thing to be able to say. And a crime writer as well. I think that always gets people a little bit more interested. So I think I wish I'd known that there's no point, is there, I think, that you think, wow, I've really made it. You know, there's still things that I want to do and want to achieve. So, you know, it's not winning a dagger. It's maybe not being number one. I think really, I wish I'd known that it's always just about the next book, which is quite nice in a way.
So what have you learned about writing and how do you manage to kind of be disciplined enough to get those two books out a year?
One of the things that I have learned, and I think it probably does come from having written a lot of books now, is I do have a bit of a confidence that it's going to work out, if you know what I mean. So now I don't do a written plan. I used to do a written plan for every book and have the plot all worked out and everything. And in fact, I teach creative writing, as you know, at West Dean, and I teach plotting, and I feel a bit of a fraud because I don't plot really. But I think now I have the confidence that when I sit at my computer, I don't necessarily have a great idea in my head, you know, inspiration can come at the end. So I sit there and I start a book and I have the confidence that it's going to come. So I think that possibly is something I've learned, and it's not really something about the art of writing. It's probably something about me that now I feel that, okay, I can start the book and I know an idea will come and I know the plot will work it out. And if it doesn't, I'll make it work out. You know, thank goodness we can go back and change things. I always think about writers like Dickens, and Wilkie Collins is my favourite writer. How did they do their plot when they had to go back with their quill and sort of add an extra character in the beginning? I guess I've learned that it will work out in the end. And you don't have to have a brilliant idea, don't have to have this fantastic high concept idea for it to work out.
So that actually leads me really nicely onto my next question, which is, what are your tips for writing something with bestseller potential? And what do you think it is about the kind of bestsellers like that you see that really captures people?
Well, I think the first thing to say is really never think I'm going to write a bestseller, because nobody knows what's going to be the next bestseller. It's one of the things I love most about publishing, actually. And I used to work in children's publishing, actually, and I was at HarperCollins. I was editorial director for children's fiction just after the big sort of HarperCollins thing, the big Harry Potter thing, which HarperCollins turned down. And of course, we were all thinking, what's going to be the next Harry Potter? But we knew that it wouldn't be about a boy wizard. And you can't always tell what's going to be the big bestseller. Look at sort of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. Nobody saw that coming. And that was his sixth book, really. Look at Short History of Tractors in Ukrainian, which I think is about 10 or 12 years ago. It was a massive success. And who would have thought that with that title, really, that it was going to be such a huge bestseller? So I think the first thing to think is, don't try and second guess the market, because the wonderful thing about the publishing market is you never know. You know, Eleanor Oliphant, who saw that coming? Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, who saw that coming? Nobody really. So don't think about that. I would think about getting the voice. The voice is the most important thing. It's the most important thing to an editor when they see, when they first read a submission, is there a voice that really grabs me? And I think all those books that I've mentioned, you know, all those Lessons in Chemistry is another great example. I mean, what a title. You'd never have thought a book called Lessons in Chemistry would be an absolute global bestseller. But I think the voice in that book is so amazing. So I think, don't think about it being bestseller. Write the book that's in your heart and concentrate on having a very believable and winning. And you don't have to love the person, but it has to be a relatable voice. So that's what I would say.
So when we talk about voice, do you have any top tips of how you kind of really master your character's voice? Because I think consistency, especially through your Ruth Galloway series, is going to be so, so important.
Yes, and it is an interesting thing, isn't it? And I think sometimes the voice just comes, and sometimes you do have to work a little bit at it. I guess the biggest tip I would give, and it's not, you know, it's not universal, because some wonderful bestsellers are written from a sort of omniscient narrator point of view. But I would say that for me, when the book is being a bit tricky, as of course they always are sometimes, is to go tightly into that character's point of view. So really try and think about what your character is seeing, smelling, tasting, what they would see, how they would describe landscape. I mentioned Wilkie Collins earlier on, and there's some amazing descriptions in that book of the shivering sands, this very doom-laden place sort of where the house is set. But they're always described through the point of view of the character. You always see them through the character's eyes. So for me, it would be, you know, tighten that focus and try and look through your character's eyes into the screen, if you know what I mean. So really try and be that character. And I think for me, that's always when the book sharpens up.
Amazing. That's great advice. Thank you. So your latest book, The Last Word, is out now. Can you tell us a bit about this book? What is the elevator pitch?
Well, The Last Word starts when one of the characters is reading the obituaries in the local paper, which is one of his great hobbies. And he realizes that a lot of the obituary writers are predeceasing the person that they're writing about. Is there a pattern of obituary writers being murdered? And this brings together Edwin, who calls himself the oldest sleuth in the world, oldest sleuth in England anyhow, and Natalka, who is a Ukrainian carer who has now started a detective business, and their friend Benedict, who runs a coffee shack on Shoreham Beach. So the three of them are an unlikely group of sleuths who try to solve the problem of, try to solve the mystery of the obituary writers.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so much fun. Who really inspired this book? What authors have inspired you in your writing?
Oh, well, that's a great question, really. I think my writing is very inspired by Wilkie Collins and those sort of 19th century writers, in a way, that whole sense of place. And in this book, they go to a writer's retreat, actually, called Battle House in Battle. And that kind of sense of a place itself having an atmosphere. I think I'm very inspired by that. But also there's a writer called Nancy Spain, who's quite out of favour now. But she wrote a wonderful book set in a kind of decaying seaside resort, not that Shoreham is that, but or Brighton, but, and it's called R in the Month, and it's about poisoned oysters. And I just think it's a wonderful book about writing about a seaside resort out of season, and when it's all a little bit sad and tired. So I would definitely say she is an inspiration. Also, I have to say Agatha Christie. Every time I think I've got a wonderful plot, I remember, realize that Agatha's already done it. Good thing I like her, otherwise I'd be going off her by now.
That's really funny. So you often set your books in and around Sussex. Is it important for you to do that because you live here, or kind of does it go beyond that?
Well, in a way, I sort of hesitated before setting a book in Sussex. Although I have to say, I've just come across my first attempt at a crime novel, which was written when I was 11. And it is set in Rottingdean, which is very near where I live now. So obviously I then was quite happy to set books in Sussex. But I think one of the reasons why the Ruth books were set in Norfolk was because it was somewhere I'd been to on holiday as a child, and I knew fairly well because my aunt lives there. But it was a little bit removed, and I think places that you only know a little bit can seem a little spookier, a little stranger. So I held off writing about Brighton, although it's a wonderful setting for books, as we both know, because I knew it so well. I've lived here since I was five, and I think my way into Brighton was writing about it in the 50s and 60s, and in that theatrical world, the last days of variety, the last days of musical, really. So giving myself a little bit of remove, because I think for me, Brighton, I love Brighton so much, and it feels a very safe and homely place to me, which isn't always a great thing for a crime novel.
No, absolutely. So obviously this is our Brighton bestseller show, and I'd really like to know what it's like to be a writer in Brighton.
Well, of course it's wonderful, because everything's wonderful in Brighton. I'm a big fan of the place. But in a way, it's not the best place to be a writer, just because there are so many of us. And we're all very friendly, and, you know, great friends with William Shaw and Leslie Thompson, to name two, Julia Crouch, Simon Toyne. We all sort of socialise together and do things together, and we're all very supportive of each other. But I think the thing is, because there's so much going on in Brighton, and there are so many writers, it's sometimes quite hard to become known, and sometimes quite hard to get people to come to your events. I have to say that I can do an event in Norfolk, not saying that there's not much going on in Norfolk, but sometimes if I'm in a little village in Norfolk, you know, you can get 100, 200 people because it's the only thing that's happening in the village that week or that month. But in Brighton, everything's going on all the time. So I think it is a little difficult sometimes to get people to come to events and things. But it's a wonderful place to live and a wonderful place to be a writer. And there's a very supportive, tight, close-knit group of crime writers here.
I've always found that crime writers, despite what they write, are some of the nicest people in the industry.
Well, I couldn't possibly comment, but I do agree with you, really. And, you know, as I was saying, I used to be an editor, and I published children's books. And not saying that children's writers are difficult, because I worked with some wonderful ones like Michael Morpurgo, who's a genuinely lovely man. But I didn't find the same collegiate sense that you do get in crime writers. And I don't know if it's because we put out all our evilness and bad thoughts into our plots and our books, and what's left is just, you know, a sort of goodwill to all men. But we do crime writers do tend to be both good fun, we love a party, and actually, as I say, quite collegiate. I think one of the things is, if I see a crime novel at the top of the bestseller list, I think, oh, good for us. You know, it's kind of a win for the team in a way. I don't think, oh, I wish it was me. So I think we do feel part of a group and part of a gang. And that's a really lovely thing.
It is really lovely. It's really lovely and doesn't go unnoticed by the people that work with you. And I've actually personally found romance writers to be some of the more spiky.
I have heard this. And I've heard that, see, crime writing conventions and festivals are a huge amount of fun. And I have heard the same is not always true when romance writers get together.
Obviously, you can write into the show and debunk that myth.
Yes, of course.
Ellie, how can we find and follow you? And where can we find your short stories?
Right. Well, I'm on X, formerly Twitter, as Ellie Griffiths, Facebook again as Ellie Griffiths, and Instagram as Ellie Griffiths. So please do contact me in any of those places. I love hearing from readers. The short stories are coming out in June, and it's a collection of various short stories in a way that I've collected over the years. So they're not all crime and they're not all about Ruth, but you will find a couple of new Ruth short stories there. And also a couple of short stories about my other characters, Max Mephisto, the magician, and Justice Jones, who's the heroine of my children's books. And you'll find out what she does when she grows up.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us, Ellie.
Thank you, Anna. It's been great fun, and good luck to all Brighton writers out there.
Next up on our Brighton bestseller show, I am delighted to have Dorothy Coombson with me in the studio. Dorothy, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, nice to see you again.
Please, can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your books?
Yes, this is hard actually, because I'm me and it's hard to kind of, usually people introduce me, so I'm trying to think of what people say. Okay, my name's Dorothy Coombson. I have written 19 books. This is my 20th year of being published. I live in Brighton-ish, and my first book was published in 2003, The Cupid Effect, and my latest book is about to be published in 2024, is Every Smile You Fake. And I used to be a journalist. I still am a journalist in my heart. I love reading. I love watching telly. And I like living in Brighton.
You've talked about your career spanning 20 years, but I'd love to know how you went from picking up the pen to becoming a bestseller. What has your journey been?
My journey has been long and varied. It's one of those stories that it kind of meanders and then pauses for a bit. I started writing when I was very young, when I was 13. I wanted to write a book when I was 13. So I wrote a book called There's a Thin Line Between Love and Hate. And I used to write it in my exercise books every night and pass a chapter around, write a chapter every night in my exercise books, and then pass it around my school friends the next morning. Yeah, so I used to do that, and I kept writing short stories, and it wasn't until I was, 20 years ago that I actually got published. So I wrote a couple of books in that time, obviously didn't try to get them published, and then I had the idea for the book that became The Cupid Effect, whilst I was writing the book that became The Chocolate Run, my second book. And I'd gone to Leeds to see one of my friends, and she's older than me and been married forever. And that night, all these guys kept sending her drinks and trying to talk to her. And I was like, hey, I'm here, I'm single. Why are you talking to this married woman who is not interested in you? And the next morning, she was so hungover because all these drinks people kept buying for her. And I was like, good. But I also, she said to me, that was your fault, you know. You made those blokes like me. And I thought, oh, that's a really good idea for a novel. A woman who can't find love herself, but inspires other people to follow their heart. So I went back to London. And I sat down, I wrote the first three chapters of The Cupid Effect. And I sent it out to all these agents waiting for all these offers to come in because, you know, that's what you're told to do, write the first three chapters, a synopsis, and send it off. And I just got rejected by everybody. Literally every agent went, no, we're not interested. So I was like, fine, okay. I believe in this story. I will carry on writing it. So I finished it. And then I sent it out again. And I literally got rejected again by everybody. Everyone was like, seriously, Coopson, just leave us alone. And so I was like, okay, fine. What I'll do is I'll send it to a publisher. And at that time, I was reviewing books for a magazine. So I knew this. I knew some of the publishers. So I sent it to a small independent publisher called Piatkus, then now part of Hachette now, but at the time they were independent. And so I sent it off to them and didn't hear anything for 3 months. And I was like, okay, fine. And then I was lying in bed one morning, I was thinking, do you know what? I need to work out, shall I just give up trying to get published? Because I couldn't give up writing. So I just give up trying to get published. And so I was like, God, the universe, whoever's out there, can you just give me a sign that I need to stop trying to get published or if I should just keep going? Then there was a knock on the door and it was I used to live in flats and it was the knock on the door and it was a postman and I went down to collect the package he had for me. And it was a big package. It was quite a big package. And I could feel it had a book catalogue in it. And at the time, publishers, when they sent out books for review or to tell people what they were going to publish, they had book catalogues in. So I'd sort of like chucked it on the pile with the rest of them, which I had this massive pile in my corridor of book catalogues. And then I thought, oh, actually, do you know what? Maybe I should check because I sent my book to them. And so I went and opened it and it was an offer for a two-book deal. And so I was like, wow, that's a big sign.
Wow, that's amazing that you got that in the post. It really shows how the industry has kind of changed in the last two decades. So you have now since become a bestseller and a prolific writer. I mean, that's almost one book a year. When did you first hit that bestseller spot and what did it feel like?
It was my third book that became my first sort of like bestseller chart topper, as it were. It was my best friend's girl. I had two books published. They didn't trouble anybody, but you know, I had two books published. And so then I decided I wanted to see if I could get a bit more money, basically, because I had virtually nothing. I still had to work full time for the first two books. And we all had this fantasy that you're going to get this book deal that's going to be amazing. It's going to change your life. You're going to give up the job and you're going to go, you know, float around writing a book whenever you feel like it with all this money in the world. And that's not the case at all. And it's even more not the case now. But I wrote a part of My Best Friend's Girl, my third book. And my agent at the time wasn't keen on me leaving the publisher. So I thought, okay, well, I want to move on. So I decided to move on from her as well. And it wasn't until recently a lot of my friends told me they thought I was crazy doing that because I tried so long to get an agent and I tried so long to get a publisher. And I was just like, oh, yes, I'm going to wander off now. Now I've done two books. I'm going to go off into the sunset. So I got a new agent. I sent it to an agency and I got a new agent. And he sent it to lots of people, My Best Friend's Girl. And lots of people rejected that as well. So even though I'd had two books published, then you'd think that would make a difference. And then he sent it to somebody at Little Brown Publishing. They're still, Little Brown still exists. So they're part of Hachette as well. And she had taken over the job as maternity leave. So she was being left alone to do whatever she wanted. So she bought quite a few books. Mine was one of them. And when I met her, she sort of said, have you got anything else to show me of this book? And I was like, no, I haven't. So I wrote it. I sat down and wrote it. And then I decided to move to Australia, as you do. So I went to Australia when the book was published in 2006. And I came back for my book launch. And I remember going to the pub with one of my friends, and we were talking about the charts with this barman came over. We were talking about the book charts, the bestseller charts. And he was like, he said to me, "Can you just knock that book off the top if you could?" And I was like, "Yeah, because that's going to happen, mate." Because it got into the charts at 35, which was like the most amazing thing in the world. And so I went back to Australia, and then the book just started selling so much. It got into one book club, a bookshop book club, and then Summer Reads book club, and then it started selling. And then it was picked for the Richard and Judy book club, Summer Reads book club, as it was back then. And then it just went, phew. But before that, we had like posters, there's like tube posters. So like I was walking around going, "Oh my God, there's me with a tube poster." And I had sort of took pictures in front of me waving in front of the tube poster because it's so exciting. And it still is exciting. It still feels new. And every time a book comes out, I have to go to the shop to see if it's there. And, you know, it's very exciting.
It's really nice to see that you kind of have still got that level of excitement, however many books later. So I'd really like to know what you've observed that has changed around the publishing industry in the last 20 years, because it's, you know, for me, even in the last 10 years working in it, it's changed a lot.
Yeah, it has changed. And not all of it for the better, I have to say. You know, some of it is authors' lives are really hard, a lot harder nowadays. I'm not going to start moaning because I've got the best job in the world. I love my job and I'm very fortunate that I can do my job and I don't have to get up and go out, leave the house to do my job every day. But I know a lot of authors do, and a lot of authors are under a lot of pressure to publicise their books themselves and feeling responsible for things not going right. I don't think there was as much of that as there is now. Because of social media, a lot of authors do feel under pressure to constantly be talking about their books on social media. And sometimes, I swear, it feels like we're all just shouting. We're all just opening our windows and shouting and going, "I've written a book, I've written a book, and I've written a book." And, you know, everyone's saying that. And it's like, it feels like there's just so much of that going on. And it's really hard. And if you're not a natural social media person, it can feel really difficult to do that and to know what to do. I think over the years, communication has changed. So whereas I think a lot of people kind of felt, hopefully this is a good thing, but felt sort of like very removed from their editors, now they feel like they can talk to their editors and have proper communications and a proper working relationship with their editors, and not so, "Oh, I've sent a book in and then that's it, it disappears behind the curtain." They do stuff and then it kind of appears again. I hope people feel like they can be more involved. I think there's been more talk of diversity, but I don't know. Well, I know it's not great. It's still not great. And, you know, it's a bit better than it was, but it's not great. And I think it's sad for, not just for authors, but I think for publishers, the fact that they don't, a lot of the times, don't commit to actually doing something to change the landscape, because readers want all sorts of things. And you can see from all the stuff that people watch and from all the different countries that people watch programs from, you know, from the BBC 4 Nordic noir stuff to all the sort of like African and Indian movies and stuff on Netflix, you can see that people are interested in other books and books by people who aren't normally represented in the publishing industry. And there's more independent publishers. That's great. I think that's great. I mean, a lot of them have shrunk, but a lot of them have come out again. people doing different things and trying different things. And I think more people are involved in publishing, readers more are involved in publishing, and I think they want more from authors, and sometimes that's not a good thing, but sometimes it's a great thing, you know. It's finding the balance between a reader getting to know the person who's writing the books that they love and sort of like overstepping the bounds, as it were, you know. But you've got to kind of, I think a lot of authors need help sort of like working out where the boundaries need to be, so you don't feel like you're constantly having to give all your stories and all your life to the world just so you can sell a book.
Absolutely. So your new book, Every Smile You Fake, is out now with Headline Review. Can you tell us a bit about this book? What is the pitch?
See, I haven't got this down, and I should have had it down by now. The pitch is about, it's basically about a profiler called Kez, she's a profiler and a therapist, and she helps her friend out at a book launch one night and goes back to her car and opens the back seat of her car and discovers a newborn baby. And she's like, oh my goodness, someone's left their baby in my car. She knows who, she realizes, works out quite quickly who the baby is, whose baby it is. And there's a note saying, please don't try and find me. You'll put my baby in danger. I'll be in touch soon. So she is like, okay, I've got to take this baby home. And wondering what has happened to the mother. The mother is a social media star called Brandy, who has completely disappeared from sight. And she and Kez were very good friends. Kez took her in when she was a bit younger. And now she's got her baby and doesn't know what's happened to her. So Kez is now torn. Does she look after the baby as she's been asked to, or does she look after the baby and then try and find Brandy before it's too late? Because she knows the only way Brandy would leave a baby is if there was something, she was in proper danger. And that's a very long elevator pitch. So I hope it was a very tall building.
It was a tall building. We were on the 13th. I would really like to know if you have any advice for anyone listening who is really aspiring to hit that bestseller spot. What advice would you have?
I would advise, my biggest piece of advice is to actually write a book. This, you know, people wish all the time for this and this, and then that they'll actually do what the basic thing is, and the basic tenet is that you have to write the book. Mm-hmm. And you have to write the best book you can. Mm-hmm. You have to believe in your book as well, because don't try and write a book that you think is going to be like the ones that are top of the bestseller charts now. You know, there's certain books that are really selling and at a certain top of the bestseller charts, and people think, okay, I'm going to write a book like that. And honest to God, that's just the worst thing to do, because publishing moves so slowly. So by the time your book is published, people will have moved on from those books. Yeah. They'll still be buying them, but they won't be buying them in the sort of the volume that you want to be a bestseller. So write a book you want to write. Write the book you want to write. Write the book you believe in. Write a book that you will still love when you're rejected by everybody in the book, like I was. You know, you've got to, that's what's going to keep you going. When everyone says no to you, what will keep you going is believing in the story that you have. And if everyone does say no to you, say, okay, fine, put it aside. If you've got no other options, don't keep rewriting it and sending it out. Put it to one side, start again. Start a new book. And that will help you get a book deal, because what publishers want more than anything is to have somebody who wants a career, who wants to write more than one book, and who wants to write more than one book in you know, two books or three books in more than over the course of a year or 2 years. They do not want people who want, if you're writing commercial books like I do, do not want somebody who's going to write a book 1 year and then a book another 3 years time. That's for literary people. For commercial books, you need a book a year or a book every 18 months, 2 years. So put it to one side and then know that you have that book there. So when you get a publishing deal, you've got one book you're writing and then one book you've already got written already. So your quid's ahead, your streak's ahead. But also, be realistic. Very few books are huge bestsellers, okay? You can get onto bestseller charts, you can sell very well, for example, in ebook or audio. There are so many different formats out there now. So don't be stuck I want to be in a paperback or hardback number one mode, okay? Be realistic about the chances are, because like I say, loads of books don't. More books don't get to the top than do. But you know, the charts are 50, there's 50 books in the top in the best selling charts. So that, you know, your chances are better to not get to the top but get into the charts and keep going. You know, you just have to keep going. If you need a sign to keep going, this is your sign to keep going, you know, yeah. And to do your best and accept that you might not become a bestseller, but that doesn't mean you won't be an author. That doesn't mean you won't be a bestseller in your genre, in your street. You know, you need to kind of be realistic about what's going to happen, because publishers don't spend the money they used to on marketing and publishing. They don't spend it in the same way they used to.
Yeah.
You're not going to get necessary posters first time. You're not necessarily going to get into all the bookshops. These are the things that people don't realise when they go into the publishing world. And so if you do kind of realise it, you kind of need to manage your expectations. So when it does happen, it is great.
That's great advice. Thank you so much. So Dorothy, you are based just outside of Brighton, and obviously this is the Brighton Book Club. So I'd love to know what it's like to be a writer here.
It's great, actually, because there's quite a few writers down here. And I know quite a few of them. I don't see them very often. Sometimes we meet up for like Christmas drinks or something. It's great being in Brighton. It's a great place to set books. It's a great place to, there's quite a few bookshops around here now. There didn't used to be, but there are quite a few now, and it's great. Yeah, it's great being in Brighton. But then I think I'm quite happy wherever I live. So, but I do have a particular affection for here, because it is nice. Even when it's miserable, it is quite nice to be down here by the sea and walking on the seafront or going through the lanes. It is actually just great to be here.
Dorothy, how can we find and follow you?
I am on all the social media, everything. I'm on everything, Twitter or X or whatever it's called now. I'm on Instagram, I'm on Threads, I'm on Mastodon, I'm on, what's the new one? Blue Sky. I'm on all of them. But the best way is to sign up for my newsletter. And this is a piece of advice I'd give to writers, particularly new writers. Build up your own platform, build up your newsletter so people can get in touch with you if, you know, all the social media things go down. It's actually a better way to communicate with people, with readers. So I've got a newsletter. You can sign up through my website, which is dorothycoonson.co.uk. So you can find me everywhere. I'm everywhere, all over the place.
Thank you very much. Every Smile You Fake is out now with Headline Review. Jack Jordan, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've been really looking forward to chatting to you.
So this is our Brighton bestseller special. And I know that you've had a really kind of long journey to get to become a best-selling author. So I'd really like to hear about that kind of journey from picking up the pen to write your first book to becoming a Sunday Times best-selling author.
Yeah, of course. So I started writing at the age of 17. I actually had agoraphobia for a year, so I couldn't leave the house. And so I started writing through that to kind of pass the time. And it was kind of a bit of an awakening time for myself as well, because as a child, I'd always loved reading and writing, but I'd never made the correlation between what I love to do and the books on the shelf and that being an opportunity for me. I don't know whether that's us being, that's me being coming from a working class background or the way that society treats creative pursuits, but it never clicked. But then when I was stuck in the house with nothing more to do, and I had this idea rattling around my head and I didn't know what to do with it. So I was up at 5 a.m. and I had a BlackBerry, if we remember those, and I was typing out the short story to get out of my head, and then went to sleep. And then the next day I woke up and decided to write a little bit more. And then the next day a little bit more. And then 6 months later, I've written a 100,000 word novel and I realised that it's what I'd wanted to do my whole life and why I had to continue pursuing. But if only that were the end of the story and everything was happy ever after. But we, you know what we like, we know about publishing. It's a very long, arduous journey. I wrote 3 more consecutive novels and would get a little bit closer each time in the publishing process, but never quite got to where I wanted to get. So in 2015, there was a self-publishing boom happening at the time. And so I decided to take advantage of that and self-publish my first book, Anything for Her, which sold really well, followed by my second book, My Girl, which sold really well. And so after 6 months of My Girl's release, the two books had sold over 100,000 copies. So it was from that success that I got into mainstream publishing. I signed with my first publisher, I signed with my first agent and released 3 more books. And then there was a very pinnacle point in my career. So after 10 years after first writing, from when I was stuck in the house at 17, I found myself at a crossroads in my career where I no longer had an agent, I no longer had a publisher. I'd essentially lost everything. Due to one book not having great sales, which is quite a common story in publishing. This was the end of 2019. And then in 2020, I thought to myself, well, I've got to just prove everyone wrong. I've just got to get back in this. I've got to make it successful myself again, like I did before. And then what happened in 2020? We were all locked back inside our houses. So the only thing I knew to do was to write again. And the book I wrote was Do No Harm, which then changed my career in phenomenal ways. I signed with an amazing publisher, Simon & Schuster. I signed with an amazing agent, Madeline Milburn. And then when it was released, a Sunday Times bestseller. And it's just been an amazing ride ever since. And I love to tell that story because I think it's really important to highlight the persistence that's often needed in this environment and in this industry. And that all you can do is believe in yourself 150%, because that's usually what it takes to get you to each stage.
So conviction, like Do No Harm, asks a really interesting moral question. And at the heart of a lot of your books are these big dilemmas. I would call you the king of the moral dilemma. How has that become something that is really prevalent through your writing?
That's a lovely question. I think moral dilemmas have always fascinated me. I think because when I'm reading a book, I put myself into the character's shoes and love to ask, what would I do in this situation? So as a writer, I want the reader to ask themselves that. I want them to feel like they're in the main character's predicament and be given 2 options, and neither are choices that they want to make, but the circumstances make them have to do it. So I first explored that with Do No Harm, and that was a medical moral dilemma where a heart surgeon had her child abducted and she would never get her child back or see them again unless she killed a high profile patient on the operating table. So she had to take her oath or the love of her child into consideration. So when it came time to write my next book, Conviction, I wanted to continue exploring that moral dilemma theme. And I was looking at what is just as important to us as our own autonomy in terms of trusting doctors with our welfare. And that was our freedom. I mean, imagine being charged with a crime that we confess we didn't commit, and yet the person who is employed to look after us may not have our best intentions at heart. And again, that I was exploring, if someone has been charged with murder, if the person who is going to throw them under the bus, what if they have a very murderous past themselves? So I think I really like to, beyond the moral dilemmas, beyond the thriller plots. It's really an exploration of the human soul and how we can corrupt it or defend it, or it just it, it's I think I love to pull characters apart and understand what they are, and I think under these very stressful circumstances is where we really meet the characters.
Absolutely. What do you think it was about Do No Harm that bumped it to that bestseller status?
I think, you know, I think there's a lot of things at play. I think publishing is a very unpredictable industry. I think you can, and I think lots of things have to line up. So I think when I was at that crossroads in my career, I knew I had to create a book that publishers couldn't say no to and agents couldn't say no to. I had to create something that got me back in. And by doing that, I came up with an idea that was high concept, that was very marketable, could be described in a one hook. So that's what I could do, and then write a strong book. But then the next thing that's really important is having a publisher who shares the same ambition as you, and having an agent that shares the same ambition, because often they can be unaligned. And so I think if you have that trifecta of you, your agent, and your publisher all have the same goal in mind, I think that just automatically lines up. With Simon and Schuster, I can't sing their praises enough. I just think we're a phenomenal team together. And then luckily, I've garnered a lot of amazing readers along the way in this journey. And I think they're equally just as important in growing this buzz and growing this brand to what it's become. I think, and also, and I, however hard we work, however hard or, you know, we strive and push, luck also has a huge, you know, has a huge play in this. You know, I was very lucky that I wrote my book and it was submitted at a time when an editor was really looking for this, and where the audience were really looking for something like this. So there's also a factor of luck in there as well.
You wish you could tell 17-year-old Jack writing on his BlackBerry that you've learned along the way in the last just over a decade.
I love that question, and I've never been asked that before. I love it so much. I think I would tell him that everything you're daydreaming of and putting on your manifestation board and all the things that you're dreaming, yeah, all those dreams you have are going to come true. And I think you just have to use that stubbornness you've got within you, and that fight and that survival needs you've got within you, that it's all going to pay off. And I think, yeah, I think you'd be very, very happy to see how it's all worked out. I'd say I wouldn't change a thing.
So what are your top tips for anyone listening that thinks, right, success for them is hitting that bestseller spot? What would your top tips be? Because I know that you do a lot of work as an author, kind of with your branding and your outreach. Would that be something that you'd suggest kind of looking into?
I approach each publication with what can I do in tandem with my publishing team to make this as strong as it can be. So we all have a chat about what can work and what they're going to do, what I'm going to do. And I think social media is a huge part in this. I think creating platforms where you have bonds with people and you chat to people, because these are people who are just like us. So readers and writers are very, very similar, if not the same, in that we all love books and we all have connection through that. So I think if you build an authentic connection with your audience and through what you post, how you chat, how you connect, I think that's probably one of the most important things you can do. I think because you need that support and you need that allyship and you need that fun to make it fun. I think that's actually one thing I'd always say, is make sure you're enjoying the journey. And I think because marketing can be fun and social media can be fun. And I think going to these things as your authentic true self pays off in dividends. So I think that is something that would work really well. And I think also definitely it goes back to the being in alignment with your agent and publisher. I think deals are struck like 2 years before a book comes out. So you have a lot of time to ask what people's ambitions are. So you know where you are on the same page. And if they don't align, you can always ask questions and try and steer it in that direction. And I think that's what something that having an amazing agent in your corner is there for, and making sure you choose the right publisher is a big decision in the beginning, I think, to get you to the other end.
Absolutely. So, like I said, Conviction is out now in paperback. Can you tell us a bit more about this book and perhaps read a short extract to us?
Yeah, sure. So, so Conviction is about Neve Harper. And so not only is she a barrister who has worked incredibly hard to get where she is in her field, but she's also the wife of a missing man. He went missing 2 years before the current day of the book. And we just know that it's under very mysterious circumstances. So we can see her working through her grief, and she's got a relationship with her stepdaughter and her mother-in-law that's quite strenuous, but they're the only family she has. She grew up in care. She didn't have family. And from the age of, from being a child, she struggled with sleepwalking. So we kind of, this character that is quite lonely and is striving for acceptance within her role and hanging on for dear life to a family that technically isn't hers. I think so we find her, she's very, very survival driven character. So when she's put under these circumstances of the messenger telling her to throw the case and put in jeopardy everything she's created, we really get to know her beyond skin deep. And I loved writing this character. I loved doing all the research for the legal aspect, but also just the very dark things that happen in the book and how far can I push a character. And I think that was a really fun thing to play with. But yeah, so I'm going to read a section of Conviction where we meet Neve on the tube, and she's just met with her client Wade Darling for the very first time, and she's trying to gauge if he's innocent or guilty. And then we may at the very end of this meet the messenger. Is Wade Darling innocent? Is he guilty? It isn't my job to know, to feel. I'm not hired to decide who is right or wrong. That is for a jury to decide. Something I remind myself of every time I take on a case that makes me question my moral compass. I mustn't even allow myself to wonder in case it impacts my impartiality. I cannot afford to form a grudge against the man whose only chance of a fair trial rests firmly on my shoulders. The death of the Darlings and the thought of the empty house that awaits me makes me think of my husband, Matthew. He usually creeps to the forefront of my mind when I find myself alone. I had been emotionally attached during the vigil. I was practically gritting my teeth through it. I wonder if my mother-in-law, Maggie, and my stepdaughter, Hannah, spotted my cold front. Guilt fills my gut, sloshing from the rocking motion of the carriage as I attempt to bury the thought of him down again. The tube slows and judders to a stop at Liverpool Street. I start to get myself together at the end of the line approaches. A short walk to Oldgate to Whitechapel and I'll be home. Sometimes I take the district line to take me straight there. But on nights like this, when my mind is weighted down by work, I crave the fresh air to clear the fog, to feel the night breeze against my paws after so many hours in the stale air of chambers and courtrooms. A shadow catches my eye. A man dressed in sports gear is headed along the train. It is just the two of us now, and I suspect he'll be heading further up the carriage to make a dart for the station exit to avoid extra warp along the platform. The closer he gets, the more he seems to tower over me. His trainers must be a size 13, but instead of passing me by, he sits in the seat directly opposite mine, slipping off his sunglasses and smiling, smelling of cigarettes and brute. I stare at the man, dark-haired and broad-shouldered, with pitted olive skin that's wrinkled around his eyes. I sigh quietly to myself, hardening against the man's presence, my face souring. It wouldn't be the first time I was hit on while on the tube. Hello, Neve. The use of my name makes me pause. We stare at each other wordlessly, rocking in the sink with the carriage, as my heart rate slowly begins to climb. I wonder if he is a former client. By the intense glare of his eyes, I must not have won the case. You don't know me, if that's what you're thinking, he says, as if I spoke aloud, but you will. I glance up at the rolling train sign towards the ceiling. The next stop is Oldgate, where this train terminates, moves across the screen. I slowly reach into my jacket pocket for my keys, slipping one between my fingers as my pulse pounds feverishly at the tips. That won't be necessary, he says, nodding towards my pocket and opening his coat with his free hand. The other is hidden within, pointing a handgun at my gut. We have some things we need to discuss, he says. Where shall we start? I pry my eyes away from the end of the gun. My heart is pacing so fast that I feel sick. My stomach coils. I know, his smile breaks open, flashing jagged yellow teeth. Let's start with how you murdered your husband.
Oh, it's so chilling. It's taking me right back there. And I really recommend the audiobook of Conviction, which I read kind of alongside reading it in paper. And it was just amazingly told. So, Jack, you are a bestseller in Brighton, as is the name of the show. And I'd really like to know what it's like to be a writer here, because you haven't always lived in Brighton.
Yeah, so I grew up in Essex and then I moved here, wow, almost 3 years ago. And I found it so freeing to be here as a creative. I think there are so many writers here. I think I see them all the time. I live in Hove, and you pass authors all the time. So maybe the listeners, you're passing them and you don't even know it. There's crime writers here, there's fantasy writers here, there's nonfiction writers. It's a huge hub of creativity. And I think writing particularly is quite an isolating pursuit. So to have people who are on the same journey with you is really freeing and really good for the soul. So I think creators in Brighton are very, very lucky indeed. And also I think being by the seaside, you know, if you ever need to work out a plot point, what better way than to walk down the beach and unpick it that way by looking out at the beautiful view.
What's next for you, Jack? Are there any exclusives you can give us about your next book?
Yeah, sure. So my next book is called Redemption, and that's out in June, on the 20th of June. And it's another moral dilemma, but it's quite different for me, I think. I'm stepping away from the profession area of moral dilemmas and just going straight to the heart of a family. So Redemption is about a mother and father going on a road trip to avenge the death of their son as the killer is being released from prison. However, it's actually the mother who's hellbent on revenge and taking a life. And her husband is terrified of losing her and knows that if she takes a life, he will lose his wife forever. So he will do anything he can to protect her, even if it means protecting the man who killed their son in order to save his wife from herself.
Wow, it's so bizarre to me because you're such a nice person and you come up with these kind of hellish dilemmas. Where do you think that comes from?
I genuinely believe I'm quite a anxious person, and I think I'm listeners with anxiety will totally probably relate with me. There's so many things that are terrifying in this world. So I think as a creative, I kind of relate to that fear and think about how I would feel in this situation, or what would be my worst nightmare, what would be this awful thing. And I think once you kind of tap into that very human fear of what's coming around the corner, I think that's just where it breeds from. I think, and also moral dilemmas are very much, I think it comes down to preservation of the self, but also love for others. And I think when you've got that dynamic as a plot, surprisingly, the greatest fears come quite easily. So I think it's a real gift, I think, for the reader to be able to put themselves in the multiple character shoes and wonder what they do in that predicament, and can any of them get redemption?
Thank you so much for joining us, Jack. It's been a pleasure having you. How can we find and follow you?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And you can find me on Instagram at @JackJordan_author. And TikTok is the same as well. Or Twitter, you can find me at @JackJordanBooks.
Thank you so much. Conviction is out now in paperback with Simon & Schuster, and you can pre-order Redemption from wherever you pre-order your books.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. The show is also available as a podcast, so you can listen to every episode we've done over the last 4 years. Wherever you get your podcast, just search for the Brighton Book Club. And if you like what you hear, please do rate and review. We will be back next month with more great Brighton writers. But in the meantime, take care, happy reading, and we'll see you next month.